This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, never one to shirk a fight, former Prime Minister Paul Keating launches an extraordinary attack on Australia's intelligence services over their views on China.
The nutters are in charge of
the security agencies that labour.
Oh, yeah, well, you clean them out. You know, when you've got the ASIO chief knocking on MPs' doors, you know something's wrong.
And the election's less than a fortnight away. Finance Minister Matthias Cormann will join me shortly. Australian universities have been waiving their own English entry requirements in a bid to recruit more high-paying international students. A Four Corners investigation's heard from academics who say they're struggling to teach international students who can't understand classes, and education agents who say they're concerned students with poor English are being granted visas. Elise Worthington reports.
It's just the best place to come, I feel. Coming to uni makes me happy.
International students are sold on a promise of being part of an Australian lifestyle at a university campus. But some students say that's not what they get.
What are the classes like so far? Are there many Australian students?
No. We have more international students. There are more Sri Lankans, Indians,
Nepalese.
Nearly a third of Australia's foreign students come from China, but in South Asia there's been rapid growth in higher education. In recent years, the number of student enrolments from India has more than doubled to 72,000. In Nepal, growth has jumped by a staggering 132% to nearly 30,000 enrolments. Ravi Lochan Singh represents the Indian education agents who are paid by universities to bring students to Australia.
I would say that it's not all universities, but there are definitely large numbers of universities still which waive English language requirements.
An English waiver means students are admitted despite scoring below the university's published English standards or are granted entry through other means, including without taking an independent English test. Universities were given more power to vet students and set their own standards under a streamlined student visa system introduced in 2016. The Immigration Department then assesses some visa applications based on the university's approval of the student. Andrew Durston is a former immigration official and now works as a private consultant.
There are too many students coming without the requisite capabilities, whether that's English, whether that's academics, whether that's financial capacity to maintain themselves in Australia. The tolerance level is too low, in my opinion.
Academics from around the country have told Four Corners they're seeing increasing numbers of international students who are struggling and record numbers of academic misconduct cases. Associate Professor Sharif Asaba is from Melbourne's RMIT University.
Look, of course, they are the cash cows. There is no doubt about it.
Professor Margaret Gardner is the chair of Universities Australia. She says universities can and should be able to set and maintain their own standards.
There is overall evidence that, in fact, the system holds up. It has good entry standards. It has good standards in terms of what it takes to successfully complete a degree.
But Ravi Singh says the reality on the ground is different.
I think there's a loophole here. And that loophole is known to all parties. No university today can say that they are not aware of what's happening.
That's Indian education agent Ravi Singh ending that report by Elise Worthington. And you can watch the Four Corners investigation into Australia's university sector cash cows tonight at 8:30 on ABC TV and iView. The pointy end of the federal election campaign's here with just 2 weeks of campaigning left. After a messy week last week, both the major parties will try and return to a policy focus. Joining me now is political reporter Tom Eagledon. Tom, good morning. There are two opinion polls out this morning, and we treat polls very cautiously at the ABC, but the leaders will be closely analysing them.
As they always do during election campaigns, Sabra, as we know, and yes, news poll this morning is still giving Labor an edge at 51-49. Ipsos, a little bit more of an edge, 52-48. They are very much in line with what we've seen over the last few weeks. There was a slight tightening in the polls at the start of this campaign, but really since then, not much. Sabra, interestingly, we do have a different picture when it comes to Bill Shorten. His approval rating's down in the news poll measures, but in Ipsos, in the Fairfax papers, he's closed the gap with Scott Morrison. So make of that what you will, Sabra, a confusing picture. They're perhaps suggesting that voters are a bit all over the shop and perhaps haven't even really turned on, especially in the last week of the campaign, to the campaign.
And what policies are the leaders going to be putting under the spotlight today?
Well, after that very messy week last week, where both leaders were really taken off track due to those social media scandals that we saw, they will try and focus on policy. As we said, both are in Sydney today. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is going to focus on his Made in Australia campaign, as he puts it, with some emphasis on those export incentives and the Manufacturing Modernisation Fund. Labor will focus on its pitch to encourage employers to take on long-term unemployed, both the young and the old. There is an argument, though, just developing this morning, Sabra, when it comes to multinational tax avoidance. A very interesting one. We'll hear now from both the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, and the opposition leader, Bill Shorten.
The retirees are going to be taxed 27 times harder than multinationals under Bill Shorten's policies. That retirees tax is going to hit $5 billion a year, and Bill Shorten is going to totally let multinationals off the hook.
We've said that we want multinationals to pay their fair share. I announced yesterday, actually, a new scheme to stop some multinationals treating the Australian tax system as a doormat, which they, you know, wipe their boots on coming in and out of Australia. We've also said that we want to wind back unsustainable negative gearing.
That's the opposition leader, Bill Shorten, speaking there on Channel 7 this morning, and before him, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, on Radio 2GB, and, of course, our reporter, Tom Eildon. The Finance Minister, Matthias Cormann, joined me earlier from Brisbane. Matthias Cormann, welcome to AM. Ipsos and News Poll show Labor on track for victory. 12 days from polling day, more than 600,000 people have already voted. Is it too late?
Well, we will continue to work to earn the trust and the confidence and the voting support of a majority of Australians in a majority of seats. You know, we are not obviously taking anything for granted. This election is close. Every vote will matter, and we will continue to work hard to explain to the Australian people why this is not the time to risk our economy with Labor's $387 billion in higher taxes, which would harm the economy, cost jobs and leave families worse off.
But by saying that you need to earn the trust of people, there's an acknowledgement that you've lost their trust.
No, well, I mean, obviously we have a track record of having turned the economy around, having turned the budget around, having ensured that funding for all of the essential services Australians rely on across health, education, you name it, welfare, the NDIS. We have been able to guarantee all of that funding, put it on a sustainable foundation and trajectory for the future and ensure the budget is in surplus. But, you know, of course, we've got a plan for the future to continue to build a stronger economy, create more jobs and keep the budget in surplus, and we'll have to continue to engage with the Australian people, of course, over the remaining 12 days, and that is precisely what we're doing.
Labor's campaign launch yesterday sent a very strong message of unity with Mr Rudd and Ms Gillard in the same room, combined with a vast front bench of women. That contrasts against the coalition. It's unlikely you'll have Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull, Scott Morrison standing alongside Peter Dutton and Greg Hunt at this weekend's coalition launch. Along with the front bench of experienced women, that's quite a contrast.
Well, I thought that it was quite striking yesterday that both Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd, of course, were the victims of Bill Shorten's, you know, obviously not being able to be trusted by either of them, you know, over years gone by. So I'm not quite sure what that demonstrated. We have a strong and united team.
They both turned out in support and against.
Well, of course, and you know, we are a strong and united team. We are focused on implementing our plan, which is designed to build a stronger economy, create more jobs, and ensure that families around Australia have the best possible opportunity to get ahead. Whereas Bill Shorten, of course, is pursuing an agenda, a high-taxing agenda, which would weaken the economy, put jobs at risk, and leave families worse off. That's the choice that the Australian people have in front of them.
Just digging into a couple of those points. Now, the Coalition's campaign, by contrast, is largely Scott Morrison, essentially one salesman for an entire team. That is quite a contrast.
We have a very strong team. You know, obviously, you know, from you know, Scott Morrison is supported by a very strong team with Josh Frydenberg, of course, as the deputy, Michael McCormack as our deputy prime minister, Bridget McKenzie. You know, all of us. We're working very hard to support the Prime Minister, and we will continue to do so in the years ahead, assuming, you know, if the Australian people give us their confidence again at this election.
The Coalition argues that Labor is big taxing, but the ALP says its priority is fair go economics. Do you concede that many voters who've been struggling with flat wages and inadequate services might find these policies and spending priorities very attractive?
Well, wages under Labor would be lower because a weakening economy, which leads to rising unemployment, leads to lower wages over time. I mean, the only way...
But to the nub of that question, some voters actually might find these spending priorities quite attractive.
Labor is not coming clean with the Australian people about the impact of their high-taxing agenda on the economy, on jobs and on families around Australia.
We'll know their costings by the end of the week. They've promised to outlay them by Thursday, Friday.
Well, so far, Labor has avoided explaining to the Australian people what the impact on the economy, on jobs and on families is going to be of $387 billion in higher taxes. And that is because they know that this sort of increase in the tax burden will harm our economy, put jobs at risk and leave families around Australia worse off. That's why they're avoiding having this conversation.
If the Reserve Bank cuts interest rates tomorrow, many will interpret that as a sign that the economy isn't in a very good way. What responsibility does the Coalition shoulder if that happens?
Well, I mean, we are facing downside risks in the economy. We are facing global economic headwinds, which is why this is the worst possible time to impose $387 billion in higher labour taxes on our economy, which would put us in a weaker position, which would put jobs at risk and which would leave families worse off. I mean, that's the whole point. When we came into government in September 2013, Labour left behind a weakening economy, rising unemployment.
Sorry, and
a rapidly
question
deteriorating
was,
budget position.
What responsibility will you shoulder if they drop rates to a historic low?
Well, the Reserve Bank will make decisions independently based on their assessment of where the economy is at. But my point is this. The economy is in a much stronger position as a result of the agenda that we've pursued over the last 5.5 years. When we came into government, the economy was weakening, unemployment was rising and the budget position was rapidly deteriorating. Today, the economy is stronger, employment growth is much stronger, the unemployment rate is much lower and indeed the budget is back in the black. What we're saying is we are facing global economic headwinds, we are facing risks, downside risks in the economy, which is why this would be the worst possible time to go back to Labor's discredited high-taxing ways of the past, which
just,
would harm
just on that,
our
economy. The Coalition's main campaign slogan is "We're not Labor and we're not Bill Shorten." It's not a compelling, positive vision about your main argument and what
I
you
disagree.
Stand for.
Well, I completely disagree. I mean, we're standing on our track record and on a very strong agenda for the future. I mean, we've delivered more than 1.3 million new jobs. We're promising another 1.25 million jobs, moving forward. And indeed, we are saying to the Australian people, we inherited a weakening economy, rising unemployment and a deteriorating budget position. We've been able to turn that situation around. The economy is stronger. The employment growth is stronger.
Housing slumped dramatically over the past 12 months.
So what you're saying that the housing market has been softening, and which is why Labor's increased taxes on housing would be precisely the wrong way to go right now.
Paul Keating's critique yesterday that the Nutters are in charge of ASIO and he's urging a clean out. What did you make of that?
Well, that was incredibly reckless and completely outrageous and inappropriate. And Bill Shorten must explain whether he agrees with Paul Keating. I mean, he said several times during his speech yesterday that he relied on the advice of Paul Keating. That was a completely uncalled for comment. Our security agencies are doing an exceptionally good job in order to keep Australians safe and secure. And it was completely and utterly inappropriate.
Matthias Cormann, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Always good to talk to you.
That's the Finance Minister, Matthias Cormann. Israel's military says it's ready to launch an offensive in the Gaza Strip after 4 Israeli civilians were killed by rockets. It sent tanks and more than 1,000 extra soldiers to the border and told them to prepare to attack. 21 Palestinians have been killed in the fighting, which is the worst between Israel and Gaza in years. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchik reports.
Israeli jets leveled buildings inside Gaza in what Israel's prime minister called massive strikes against militants in the territory. Palestinian health officials say 21 people died and more than 150 were injured. Israel's military spokesman, Jonathan Conricus, says some were members of militant groups who were targeted while launching rockets.
We have conducted numerous attacks against military targets in Gaza, but there are still many capabilities that have not been deployed, and our aim is to defend Israeli civilians.
The Israeli military says it struck more than 250 targets in Gaza, including tunnels, storage and training facilities, and apartment buildings where senior militants lived. Militant groups in Gaza fired more than 600 rockets and mortars towards Israel, with dozens landing in cities and towns in the country's south, striking homes, schools and a hospital. One of four people who died in those barrages was a 58-year-old man in the city of Ashkelon, who was killed when a rocket landed in his front yard. His neighbour, Yossi Ben Dayan, says the scale of the attacks was terrifying.
Last night's raid was unusual, the bombing and the rate of the bombing. We're used to the alarm and the bombing, but what we had yesterday wasn't normal. The shelling was crazy, especially at 2:30 a.m.
Unlike in recent rounds of fighting, militant groups inside Gaza have not stopped firing after sustained Israeli bombardment. Gazan writer and analyst Mohammed Shahada says that's because previous ceasefires have not resulted in significant changes to Israel's blockade of the territory, and living conditions there continue to get worse.
It keeps going down and down, accelerating towards the abyss. It's you could call it a car crash in slow motion. So people in Gaza are trying to send an SOS to the world to put its act together and improve the situation.
International agencies are warning that Gaza's health system is near collapse. Israel's now stopping fuel imports due to the fighting, meaning electricity and water treatment will cease. This latest conflict could run for days, but its impact in Gaza will be felt for much longer. Mohammed Shahada says the only way to stop these deadly and damaging outbreaks of fighting is for Israel to lift its blockade.
If life in Gaza is dramatically improved, neither Hamas nor the Islamic Jihad would dare to destabilize that new status quo. So that's how the lifting the blockade would work. The problem why it would never materialize is that nobody on the Israeli side has the courage to address that problem.
That's Gazan writer and analyst Mohammed Shahada, ending that report by Eric Torchek. Former Prime Minister Paul Keating is being accused of having a Donald Trump moment after he launched a blistering attack on Australia's spy bosses, labelling them nutters. The one-time Labor leader has urged Bill Shorten to sack intelligence chiefs to improve relations with China if he wins the election. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
Within minutes of the standing ovation for Bill Shorten's campaign launch speech, a former Labor leader was taking to the airwaves offering his views on a range of contemporary topics.
The nutters are in charge.
Speaking to the ABC's political editor, Andrew Proben, Paul Keating accused the country's security agencies of running Australia's foreign policy and called for Bill Shorten to sack them if he wins the election.
The nutters are in charge.
The security agencies that would be advising Labor.
Oh, yeah, well, you clean them out.
Mr. Keating took particular aim at former Beijing correspondent John Garneau, who became an advisor to Malcolm Turnbull and helped to write a classified report on Chinese influence in Australia.
Once that Garneau guy got back from China and Turnbull gave him the ticket to go and hop into the security agency, they've all gone burko ever since. You know, when you've got the ASIO chief knocking on MPs' doors, you know something's wrong.
The former Prime Minister, who has sat on the International Advisory Council for the China Development Bank, warns that Australian security figures can't put at risk the country's relations with its largest trading partner.
They've lost their strategic bearings, these organisations. You know, China, whatever you think, China is a great state. It's always been a great state and now has the second largest economy, soon the largest economy in the world. If we have a foreign policy that does not take that into account, we are fools.
Well, I think Paul Keating is having his Donald Trump moment.
Peter Jennings is the head of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and an outspoken critic of Beijing's foreign interference activities. He says Mr. Keating's comments are ill-advised and disrespectful.
Frankly, that's not something that a former Prime Minister should do. And I think what he said was blatantly incorrect. The Australian intelligence community, more than most parts of government, has a very clear understanding about what China is doing.
And that's Peter Jennings from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, ending that report by our defence correspondent Andrew Green. During the next 2 weeks, the Royal Commission into Aged Care will turn to the often heartbreaking experiences of patients with dementia. Australia's population is ageing, and there are increasing numbers of older people living with dementia, an umbrella term for more than 100 progressive conditions of the brain, including Alzheimer's disease. The hearing will provide insights into whether the residential aged care system is coping with these challenges, and if not, what can be done about it. David Taylor reports.
Isabel Burke's 59-year-old mother has younger onset Alzheimer's disease.
When Mum was diagnosed at 54, I was 20 and I was just finishing my first year of university. My sister was 18 and she was on her second day of HSE exams, year 12 exams, when Mum was diagnosed. So it was quite a shock to us.
She says visiting her mum in an aged care facility is always confronting, and it's especially distressing if she's been given heavy medication.
There are days when we look at her and we think, oh no, mum's really getting worse. She's sleeping all day. She's really tired. We don't know how to help her. And then we find out that, well, what I would believe is excessive use of PRN medication that is causing her to be tired throughout the day, only because she's moving around in the bed at 10 o'clock at night.
The Royal Commission into Aged Care resumes this week in Sydney, focusing on the experiences of people with dementia. Dementia Australia Chief Executive Marie McCabe is giving evidence. She says carers medicate dementia patients because their behaviour can be frightening.
And carers can unwittingly cause responses that are out of character for the person and that in fact really don't support the level of care that's required.
Henry Brodati from the Dementia Centre for Research Calibration at the University of New South Wales will also be appearing at the Commission. He understands why carers might resort to using medication but warns mind-altering psychotropic drugs can be lethal.
Antipsychotics have higher rates of side effects, including increased risk of stroke and death. And often medications are not reviewed. Often they're not given with consent of the person or of their proxy. And these are things that can be remedied.
The hearing will also look at substandard clinical and personal care and the trauma that can cause dementia sufferers.
One of the things that bothers me is the number of times I see residents in nursing homes and ask to see them for, say, depression or agitation. And I go and see them and ask them what's wrong. And they say they want to be there. I'm feeling trapped. I feel imprisoned. But unfortunately, there's nowhere else for them to go. There's no family to care for them, or the family are unable to care for them. They're unable to care for themselves.
Isabel Burke hopes the hearing will lead to better care for her mum.
And it seems right now so easy for these service providers to be getting away with really poor practice.
The hearing will run over the next 2 weeks.
David Taylor reporting. Rugby union's crisis over one of its star players is still yet to be resolved. Over the weekend, an independent Rugby Australia panel conducted a hearing on whether Israel Folau breached its players' code of conduct with a homophobic social media post. The hearing was meant to finish yesterday, but lawyers for both sides say more time is needed. Meanwhile, a World Cup-winning captain has come to Folau's defence, criticising the Wallabies coach and teammates for speaking out against him. Lexi Metherill reports.
The hearing was set down for 2 days, but lawyers for Israel Folau and Rugby Australia agreed more time is needed to decide the player's future. Former Wallaby and Sydney Morning Herald columnist Peter Fitzsimons.
I think the outcome of this inquiry is so important, Rugby Union could be forgiven for taking its time and getting it right.
Rugby Australia wants the 30-year-old gone, accusing him of committing a high-level breach of the player's code of conduct. Nearly a month ago, the devout Pentecostal Christian declared on his social media platforms that hell awaits homosexuals unless they repent. Peter Fitzsimons.
My own belief is that Israel Folau has very likely gone a million, and that'll be what the inquiry will find. There are very few professions in Australia whereby if you put on social media, gays are going to burn in hell on a Monday, you'll find yourself in employment on a Tuesday.
But members of Falau's church congregation insist his message was made in love, not hate.
He's not worrying about what happens now, but what will happen later. When, once we all do die, we come under judgment when God does return. So we're proud of the servant that he is and the God that is within him, that he's able to profess and stand strong and firm and steadfast in the faith that he has for our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ.
His father, Ennie, says his son puts his faith before his rugby career.
Because we don't know what is the God plan for him. But I talked to him and he said whatever God decision to his life, he will accept.
The former Wallaby captain, Nick Farr-Jones, provided a statement in support of Falau to the hearing. The practicing Christian has spoken to ABC News Radio's Tracy Holmes and has slammed the attitude of Wallabies coach Michael Checker and senior players.
Of course he should keep his job, absolutely, but I think...
Can the Wallabies come together and unify as a team if
know.
He's back in?
I find it outrageous that coach and a whole bunch of senior players have spoken against him. I think it's probably... incompatible.
Peter Fitzsimons.
Nick Farr-Jones was one of the greatest ever Wallabies and greatest ever captains and a great friend of mine. I disagree with him on this subject. I don't think Michael Checker was out of line whatsoever. I don't think the senior players were out of line. And there is no doubt whatsoever Israel Folau has lost the dressing room.
The only rugby league player ever to come out as gay, Ian Roberts, has spoken out, saying views of the kind espoused by Folau lead to the suicides of young and vulnerable people. Peter Fitzsimons.
This is not simply a matter of freedom of religion. This is about spouting nonsense. So if you put in the public domain that gays are going to go to hell and you're implying that there's a choice to be made and if you make the wrong choice, you're going to go to hell, you're putting out there damaging nonsense.
Rugby Australia's Code of Conduct hearing is set to resume tomorrow.
Lexi Metherill reporting. The AFL has a successful American recruit, so is it the AFLW's turn? One Colorado mother believes Aussie Rules women's competition is a beacon for sporting equality, and she's heading to Melbourne determined to become the first American in league ranks. James Bennett reports from Denver.
I say I play Australian rules football, and they say rugby, and I say, no, it's not rugby.
Sarah Edwards-Rona frequently explains that distinction to folks in Denver, Colorado. Today, though, she lands in Melbourne.
You check the weather?
It's rainy and cold all week.
No more explanations. Her task now is convincing teams in the newly expanding Women's League to sign an American mum.
To make it into the AFLW, it would be me realizing a goal inside my heart.
A former rugby player, she discovered Aussie rules while waiting for rugby matches to be televised late at night. A friend convinced her to try it. Within a year, she was in Melbourne, playing for the USA at an international cup. Here, she recounts her proudest moment. In the background, the crowd's reaction.
Picked the ball up on the run, evaded a girl, just kicked the ball in toward the goal and made a 50-metre goal. People couldn't believe it. They just... And I couldn't believe it because, I mean, 50 metres is a long way out to kick a ball, especially as a woman.
She loves the contest and I think that she's got what it takes.
Former Waffle player James Waddell has called Denver home for the last 15 years. He points to the success of Collingwood's American recruit Mason Cox and the AFLW's coming expansion. Four new teams for 2020 means 120 new contracts.
The timing is really ripe for any international cross-coder.
The AFLW's explosion is something Sarah Edwards-Rona finds herself explaining almost as enthusiastically as the game itself.
Having professional women's teams who play in the stadiums, who wear the uniforms, who have the same access to facilities, and it's just absolutely massive for women's sport. You would never hear of that happening in the United States.
In the Me Too age, her distinctly American talk of pursuing dreams and opportunity seems a perfect fit for a competition that is arguably Australia's best gender equality story.
I mean, my mom always told me I could do anything I wanted. People, you know, question that. Like, why do you tell kids they can do anything? But really, you can do anything if you put your mind to it.
St Kilda, the Western Bulldogs and the Gold Coast Suns have all shown interest in a small forward with a booming kick and a ferocious streak. Now she has 1 month to turn her American dream into Australian history. In Denver, this is James Bennett for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.